So we have a talk about exploring Rauch, a flexible building block for image-based updates. Let's welcome Ruven.
Thank you very much. I work for a small company out of Germany. We do embedded Linux projects, and that's where Rauch initially came from. And I'll start by introducing the concept of field updates. So usually in the embedded Linux space, we have some kind of build server or RCI or whatever, and that produces some kind of artifact that needs to be deployed onto many more target machines out there. Maybe the project has stuff in space or somewhere out in the field, so it's not easily reachable, or sometimes people also want to do updates not only via HTTP, they want to ensure that every update is also operated by an operator and at the device, so they also want to do, for example, USB-based updates, so it's not always over the air. And the scope of Rauch is pretty much not anything related to building the artifact itself, so the image itself, it's more about generating the bundle that's going to be deployed onto the device, and then we also don't care how the bundle in the end reaches the device, we care about how to install the bundle in a fail-safe way to ensure that the device can always be booted. We want to be sure that nobody has to go out into the field and tinker with the device, and we want to ensure that it's always in an operable state. And for this, we built Rauch, which is an embedded Linux update framework. Framework meaning that we want to cover as many update use cases as we can think of, or we want to be generalized enough that your use case can also be covered by Rauch. And if it doesn't, we like very much to hear about it, because then we can adjust Rauch, maybe add new features, maybe think about the general concepts we've already implemented and update the design. It's fail-safe, it's authenticated, so we have a signature over the bundle we are installing on the device. It's always image-based, because in the embedded Linux space, we want to be image-based, and the default example everybody always has is we do an AB installation. So we have two partitions on the device, and we only ever update the one partition that is currently not in use, then try to boot into the partition, and if that doesn't work out, we can just always fall back to the known good slot we had before. And the idea is that we have some kind of bundle which contains a manifest, which I will explain later, and this contains the artifacts that are used to install the system eventually, and it also contains some hooks if you want to do a certain migration on the device itself. And on the device, we are running Rauch as a service, as a Dbus service in this case, and this way your application can just talk over Dbus to Rauch and ask, what's the current slot status? I want to install this bundle, so it's always up to your application how to do the installation. On the other hand, Rauch also needs to talk to the bootloader to ensure that we can switch over to the newly installed system for the next boot up. Rauch itself is written in C and uses glib, OpenSSL, curl, all the usual libraries you want to use, and you, because nobody wants to implement SSL or curl or some kind of async framework, which is just naturally not something you want to do. Why are we image-based in the embedded Linux space? As I've already said before, there's nobody going out to devices in the field to repair them. It's always very costly to send somebody there. And we want to run exactly the same version we already tested. So in the ideal case, when the CI produces a new build artifact, a new build image for your device, you start a test framework which tests that your device or the new image works with your device and all the features your application requires on the device are working. And this also means there's not going to be any version drift between packages on the target, because we are not using package-based update system where some packages could be updated and others are not. We are just using a purely image-based approach. And the example here is just a space device, in this case copied from the linux4space.org site, where it's totally unreachable. Even if something fails in the field, there's no way to send an operator up into space to update a small CubeSat satellite. There's just no way that's in any way financially feasible, right? So let's talk a bit about the bundle format. So bundles are the the files that are transferred to the device and which are or which contain the update artifacts. I'm talking only about the Verity bundle. There used to be an older bundle format that's still supported for older devices, but not recommended for new designs, obviously. And it's the Verity format as it uses DM Verity underneath. We have bundle contents. In this case, could be a rootfs image and an upfs image, some kind of hook for online data migration, and a manifest file. And then what we do is we put all these files into a squashfs and use Verity create to create the DM Verity tree, hash tree, take the root hash and put the root hash into the manifest, put the hash tree after the squashfs, and then sign only the manifest with the root hash. This is quite nice because we don't have to verify a lot of data. We only need to verify the root hash and the manifest data itself. And at the very end of the bundle, you can find the signature size. And now on the verification side, when we want to open up the bundle, the first thing we do is we locate the signature size at the very end of the bundle. That tells us where the manifest data is. With the manifest data and the keyring we deployed on the device previously, we go and verify that the signature for our manifest matches. With that, we have the root hash, and with the root hash and the hash tree that is also in front of the manifest, we can then access individual blocks of the squashfs. And in the usual case, the squashfs is just mounted in a runtime directory to transfer the data out from the files onto a partition or a directory or other files, and also run the included hooks. It's very nice because it's very fast initial verification, and we also have randomized access to the bundle contents. And this not only in the case we transferred the full bundle onto the device, this also works if the bundle is, for example, deployed on an HTTP server, where we can use the concept of bundle streaming. So the usual case is that you needed to download the whole bundle onto the device, which means that you have to have storage space for the complete bundle on the device. Embedded devices usually want to save storage because more storage means more costs for thousands of devices. Every cent matters. So the idea was to skip over the step and instead build an on-demand service which could download the right chunks from the bundle and just stream the data to disk without any intermediate storage required. You can see that on the left side, initially you had to download it onto some kind of data partition, or if the bundle was small enough and your RAM was big enough, you could download it into a tempfs and then install the bundle. But with streaming, this intermediate step is no longer required. So now the question is, how does this work? So for bundle streaming, we are employing an unprivileged helper. And what this unprivileged helper does is it exposes a blocked device up to Rauk. Rauk just forks off the little helper binary, and it exposes a blocked device. And on the other side, the unprivileged helper uses HTTP range requests to access certain blocks from the web server. So if I want to access like the third 4K block, I would just do a range request for this block. And on the Linux side, it looks like a normal block device. And if we now plug the DM Verity on top of it, because we can download just the root hash and the manifest using a range request as well, and open up the block device as a DM Verity device, we can access individual blocks via the HTTP range request without downloading all the data initially. That's still possible as a fallback. It always works. But if HTTP range requests are supported, we can just download a 4K block, write it to disk, and don't need any intermediate storage whatsoever. As we are talking about HTTP at the moment, the alternative in systemd land is systemd sys update, where systemd sys update works like or provides you with a set of configuration files that are in the usual etc run or user lib applications we all know well from systemd, and it takes these definitions of what to update and can then do a HTTP or HTTPS request to a SHA-256 some .gpg file, where we have a detached signature also on the web server. And the great thing about systemd this update is that we not only can store a complete disk image or a complete tar archive, we can also store individual files or individual directories. So in the example shown on the right side, we can see that we are downloading a rootfs. In this case, this is switched up. The kernel shouldn't have a tar extension, but that can be fixed later. So what we are downloading is a rootfs, and we are also downloading a kernel. And the next step systemd this update then does is that it's able to decide via your configuration files where to deploy your individual downloaded files. So the rootfs can be deployed to a partition, and you can use systemd as well to update or create a file system beforehand. And your kernel can be deployed to your EFI or ESP partition, so your EFI system partition. And we are also able to, for example, deploy a complete container to valid machines and then start the container via systemd unspawn, which is really, really nice. There's a certain difference in how Rauk and systemd this update do their authentication. So for Rauk, we are using X509 detached signature or CMS signatures at the very end of the bundle, as I've shown you in the bundle generation steps. And for systemd this update, we are usually using the very well known in the distro world GNUPG workflow, where we have the SHA-256 sums GPG and a detached signature. With that, we can verify that the file with the hash sums is correct and then download the files individually. This also means that we need to download the complete file to complete the hashing of the file, which is not really required in the Rauk case. Furthermore, the support is rather different between Rauk and systemd, because obviously Rauk came from the embedded space, so we very much needed to care about embedded bootloaders like U-Boot, or supporting grub and EFI, or grub and Barebox, or even supporting more more custom solutions we've seen out in the field, where we needed to support BIOS implementations. So you can supply a custom script that does some kind of command on your system to parameterize your BIOS to ensure that on the next boot the correct partition is booted, while systemd is very much focused on the bootloader specification, which is totally fine. For encryption, Rauk can use dmcrypt, so instead of only using dmverity to verify initial blocks inside of the squashfs in the bundle, we can also layer dmcrypt on top of it and supply a symmetric key to decrypt the file on the system, which in the embedded case also requires you to have some kind of secret storage on the device, which is not always the case, but nowadays becomes more and more possible. And for systemd, encryption is pretty much at the moment, as far as I've known, since the pluggable transports for systemd sys update are not there yet, it's pretty much limited to transport encryption via HTTPS. For targets, Rauk supports partitions, block devices, also MTD devices, because embedded devices still need to support SPI flashes or NAND flashes, and you need to erase them before writing the new data to them. So Rauk implements the correct flow of binaries to flash the data onto the device, and files and directories can, at the moment, be managed via hooks. And for systemd, as I've presented before, you can update partitions, files, or whole directory trees, as shown in the container example. For Rauk, the configuration is done inside of the manifest, so you define certain slots on your system, which are your A, B, C, D update partitions, and then you can define application partitions as well, and you can define however many you want. But we also supply hooks inside of the bundle, so every bundle update can be very customized to how you want to modify the system with this particular update. Configuration in the systemd case is done using the directories I've mentioned before, so userlib or etc, or also run if you want to supply runtime configuration. So it's totally possible to also support a case where you plug in a USB stick and then copy the correct configuration onto the device, but that needs to be done beforehand. So the very next thing we then had come up as a problem is that we want to save on the download bandwidth. Because for embedded devices, sometimes these are connected over gRPS networks or edge networks still, and you want to download as the smallest amount possible. Because in most cases in these contracts, you have to pay by the amount downloaded and not by the amount of time you are online. The conventional method to do this is delta updates, where you have a difference between two versions of your update of your system, and then you find out which is the delta of the bytes I need to update in this case. So on the left side, we have a V2 and a V3, and there's a certain difference in the blocks on the system, and we know that to get from V2 to V3, we need to update these specific blocks via a delta update. And if we take this delta update and apply it onto a virgin V2 file, we will get a V3 target. This is the optimal difference. However, it has the problem that it doesn't really work in the case where we want to update from another version that isn't V2. So there's no real specific way to support an update from the V1 version of the system where we were booted on before, because we don't have the necessary blocks to go from V1 to V2 and then to V3. And it also requires the source and target image, and you have to do the step-by-step updates. So the idea the route developers came up with is we supply the bundle capabilities inside the bundle itself. So we can always do a full download. Like, we provide the full bundle. If delta resolution somehow doesn't work out as a fallback, we can always do a full download of the bundle. We don't save any download bandwidth, but this, having the fallback is always great. Then we provide a hash index inside of the bundle. And with the hash index and the RAUC on target, we can find out which blocks of our device we need to update. So the bundle provides the optional download optimization. You have to run that before you deploy the bundle onto your online system where it can fetch the data. But then the RAUC on the target will download or will select the appropriate options to download, because it will do block-based hashing on its own block device to find out which blocks to update. So in effect, on the target, it looks like this. We have a V3 device and a hash list, and then we compare which hashes we already have or which blocks we already have on the target, and we only ever download the blocks which are required to update from a certain version to the newer version. We currently have this implemented as a block-based the block hash index. So for block-based updates, this is already implemented. This could also be implemented for file-based variants using rsync and checksums. So you can checksum in individual files and don't only rsync the files which are not in the same state on your system. But so far, that hasn't been implemented. It would be another optimization step. There are also advanced features I've already hinted at. So we can do bundle encryption. We do a symmetric encryption of the payload data using the mcrypt, and then it's kind of up to the system whether you want to have all of the systems, or you have hundreds of systems sharing the same key, or each system has an individual key to decrypt the symmetric encryption key. Having many decryption keys also means that your signature size is going to grow, so it's a trade-off you have to make for the individual use case in this case. There's also application updates, which are currently supported by just defining an application slot and then updating the whole application at once. And there are developments in progress to also support artifacts updates, because nowadays it's oftentimes the case that people not only want to update the whole partition with the application, they may also want to update a container or a certain directory on the system, or the system they are operating on is not even their own, they are just somebody else that needs to deploy a container on a system that is already in the field. So there needs to be more flexibility in this kind of space. And there are also custom metadata options. So inside of the manifest, you can supply custom metadata. In this case, it's meta-pangotronics, where we just supply some random MAC address information and a location and a class to the device. And then when the HTTP request to the bundle is made, we can send the metadata up to the server, and the server can individually decide what to respond back with. There are also community and RAUK-related projects and products. I think everybody has heard of the Valve Steam Deck, and they also had a talk here about desync. CAsync was the very initial support for not downloading the whole bundle at a time. And the patch lists for that were mainlined by Collabora for Steam Deck support. Home Assistant is also a very popular operating system that is supported by RAUK. So every time you update your Home Assistant inside of a Raspberry Pi or in a virtual machine, it will download a RAUK bundle and then update the system this way. There's the IKEA Dirigera Hub, which is a Zigbee-based device, which is also going to support Thread. As far as I know, they are running, the last time I looked, a rather old version of RAUK, but they are running RAUK. And there's also the Deutsche Bahn with Linux for ICEs, which is not running on the train itself. It's the info displays that are updated using the RAUK infrastructure, using the train info panels, and yes. So in conclusion, I've talked a bit about the RAUK service and about this update, or systemd's update. I've talked a bit about the bundle format, about HTTPS streaming, and also about Delta updates. And I have additional slides for questions you may now have after this rather fast run-through of the individual features.
So do we have questions? Questions? Any question? Yes.
Hello. So for the chunk-based, I guess it's not a Delta update, but it's an optimized download or whatever you call it, do you just split every n bytes to generate these chunks?
Yeah,
or
because
are you
it's
doing
currently
something, because something like SquashFS, you can't really split it at a fixed offset. Because as file sizes change, it changes like the size of the blocks. It would be a lot more efficient for a SquashFS system to actually parse the SquashFS file. So I was wondering if you do anything like that or plan to.
I can comment on that. So currently it's a 4K based fixed size hash. So with SquashFS it's not as efficient, but the easy fix is to use EROFS, which is aligned for 4Ks. No. The SquashFS is the bundle. That is completely independent on what you write to the partition. And the hash index is inside the SquashFS and applies to the partition image. And that can be anything.
Also for SquashFS, there is a patch that aligns the files to 4K boundaries exactly for this reason, to make it easier to split.
Where can I find this patch?
I don't know if it's been merged upstream, but it's floating around in many places, and I think it was introduced by the Chromium OS people.
You mentioned that the RAUK needs to communicate somehow with the bootloaders, for example, for the selection of the A or B partition and the fail count and so on. I'm wondering, have you thought about how to preserve integrity of this shared data Is it up to the user? For example, you can use for U-boot, you can use a UB partition or UB volume to share the U-boot variables. But how you assure that the U-boot variables set by the systems are really valid, let's say, and integer? Do you know what you mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. So for U-boot and Barebox, it's pretty much just communicating with the bootloader, and there's no verification going on which slot is booted now. One of the options for embedded systems, at least in the ARM space, would be to employ something like OPTI, where you not trust into some random data that is lying on an MTD device, but instead save the data inside of a trust zone application. And this way, your bootloader will then go to the trust zone application and ask for the data afterwards. If something like this is deployed, which adds additional complexity, of course, but then the verification of the updated boot partition is also done. Yeah.
I didn't really get how the Delta update works with the AB partitioning scheme. Wouldn't it be, because it looks like that the Delta update would be an in-place update, and I would use the currently booted partition.
I didn't get that completely.
Okay.
So you would use the partition you are currently booted from to find out which blocks to update on the other partition, and for blocks which are not on the currently booted partition, you would download them, and blocks which match the currently booted partition can just be copied over onto the second partition.
Okay, now I get it. Thanks.
Just a quick question, like you put the unprivileged helper and block device thing there, is that NBD or is it, what is that?
Okay. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you use HTTP range requests in order to fetch things chunk by chunk, especially if you can't do the real chunk-based transfer. Something that might be worth looking into is HTTP 2, because that allows you to push things alongside the main request. So that might give you some pipelining benefits, so that you have fewer round trips, and therefore fewer overhead on your network, which saves bytes.
That's already.
So you can use HTTP1, HTTP2, because that's already supported by curl, and it. But that doesn't make that much of a difference anymore, compared to HTTP1 versus 2, and you can do multiple requests in parallel. So you can do prefetching over multiple HTTP streams.
Another question, like you. You put on the slides that you do the encryption thing. What's the use case? Like, why would you download? Like, I mean, it sounds to me that encryption should always happen the moment you, like, or the verification and decryption should happen the moment you actually use the data, not when you download the data. It feels like, I mean, it's like, at least in my thinking, for example, the fact that apt or things like that authenticate the packages at download time and they're not authenticated at runtime anymore is like a conceptual error there. But this suggests, so that's the part that I don't understand. Like, it appears to me basically that if you drop configuration or keys or something with that mechanism onto the system, you should always authenticate it when you use it and not when you download it. So I was trying to.
Sometimes it's also proprietary software you
don't have. So the main use case is proprietary software or proprietary data. Like machine learning models people like to protect, or map data or something like this.
So this
was, and you also want to transport them over USB sticks, so HTTPS alone is not enough. And basically the authentication happens at both sides, during download for the hooks and the metadata, so that Raoq never touches unauthenticated data in things like a complex file system, and also we usually deploy DM Verity images, so it's also authenticated at the next boot.
So these people who have these weird proprietary operating systems, they are fine if the data at rest is unencrypted, but are okay if it's like just wanted to be encrypted separately during download, or Because that's kind of what he's saying, right? Like, because, I mean, if it's encrypted anyway, if it's at rest on the system, then why do you need to encrypt it again during download? That's the part I don't get.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I totally agree. If the data is encrypted during transfer, you want to also have the data encrypted at rest on the device.
Because the encryption key on the device is usually per device, and we don't want to create bundles for each device.
So but that implies, like, the encryption key for the transfer, like, all the systems know it, like, it's a shared key. Okay, so you have them per device after all. Look for the. Yeah, but are you saying that you don't want to maintain per device keys for the decryption of the transport? So it comes with a shared key that all the devices know, and then they.
Show the encryption slide. So
yeah, sure.
The SquashFS is basically encrypted just via DMVerity. The next one.
Yeah. Oh, this one.
Sorry, the previous one. So this one. So
this one.
One way is to have a single shared private key for all devices, so if that leaks, everything is broken. That's the easy way, but it's insecure. And then there are, you can do things like one key per production batch or one key actual per device just for the bundle transfer. And that can contain things like machine learning models and so on. And while it is installed, it's installed maybe to a DM integrity and DMcrypt partition, which uses a per device random key. Yeah, but I can't do DM integrity at this point for the whole data. Because then I would need to have fixed symmetric keys over all devices, and that's not something I want.
Well, like, I mean, it's, so at Microsoft, we have similar scenarios where we have these images and deploy them to large systems, and our way of thinking is always that transport doesn't matter. It's the images that need protection, and that would then also mean that, yeah, if you want the same image to be read by multiple devices with different keys, that you would just enroll different things there in the things. But yeah.
And I think you're also right, and I can give you another stupid reason why it might be necessary. Sometimes it's a regulatory requirement to only have HTTP encrypted transmissions, and so it's the law to do it that way. In certain, yeah. So you don't even have a choice, stupid or not.
So the main reason why I'm asking these questions is because you said that HTTPS encryption wasn't enough, and that's, I don't get that part of it, you know, like, I don't know. It sounds to me actually that HTTPS encryption is probably too much, not.
So there are cases where these things need to be transported via USB sticks to remote locations, and the guy transporting this USB stick is not trusted. So HTTP.
Yes, and also the images themselves might be stored into untrusted update servers. So it's not always a centralized system, the one pushing the update to the final device. So they need to be encrypted at rest. And due to various reasons, they might also require encryption during transport.
Anything else? We do have time, so if you have any questions, comments. So for DMVerity, actually, I have a question. You said the magic word, DMVerity, so you got my attention. So when you deploy this, do you use the DDI format, or is it just SquashFS plus DMVerity files?
It's only SquashFS plus DMVerity.
I see. Can I convince you on standardizing on the file names for that? Because, you know, in systemd world, if you have a SquashFS plus DMVerity files, we do auto-discovery. So every time you just point to a root.raw, and if there are Verity files, they're auto-discovered and used, which is amazing. But if I can convince you on using the same file names, we can share at least that track, that characteristic. Do you think that's possible? We call image.raw and then
The hash3 is a dot verity, the root hash is a dot root hash. And the signature is P7S.
There's another question over there.
All right. He hates this stuff.
No, what? No, I think, yeah, the sidecars are stupid, but you glue these things together, right? And then you put the offset at the end.
Yes.
I think one thing that Lucas had probably wanted to suggest, I don't know, is that you use GPT as an envelope, right? Like, because then they become self-explanatory and actually happen to be able to be mountable by
systemd.
Our tools, yeah. Right? Like by everything, like from, yeah, anyway. So it might be nice to unify the same format there because you're so close. You're just lacking the GPT
it's just
envelope.
Just the GPT envelope to ensure that
it's gonna be,
can mount the...
It's going to grow a couple of sectors, but it's cheap, right? Like, and it would be self-explanatory and people could use all kinds of tools to build these things, SFDisk, Repart, as we heard in the earlier talk, for example. So you would gain a lot of like a tool chain stuff that would just start working with it. So, I mean, it's an idea.
So, yes, I mean, that for DDI is all for sidecars as well. We have a standard for both. So, standardizing on either of these things. DDIs are better, yes. So, yes, if you want to, we have specs and everything else.
Any, yeah, thanks for the suggestion.
Yes. Any other comments, questions? Going once, going twice. Well, let's thank the speaker.
Thank you very much.